Hello, and welcome to the August 2009 edition of Mr. Speaker Spotlight. I'm your host, Vincent T. Edwards, better known as Mr. Speaker. My guest, the spotlight, will shine this month on Ms. Altamise Barnes. She is the founder and executive director of the Riley Center and Museum. But before we get started with this interview, just like to let you know that this edition of the Spotlight is brought to you by J-Centric, the key to your recording and entertainment needs. They do everything from audio restoration, CD duplication, live recording, studio recording. They are your key to recording and entertainment needs. That's J-Centric. You can reach them at area code 850-385-6309. That's 850-385-6309. Call them for a detailed quote or rate. That's right, J-Centric, the key to your recording and entertainment needs. My guest today is Ms. Altamise Barnes. She holds a master's degree from Florida A&M University. She is the founder and executive director of the Riley Center Museum. I mean, the honors and awards go on. I mean, her resume is truly extensive. Honors include Lincoln Teacher of the Year, Tallahassee Urban League Community Service Award, Frontiers International Community Service Award, City of Tallahassee Volunteer of the Year nominee, City of Tallahassee Historic Preservation Award, Outstanding Regional Sigma of the Year, Capital Outlook Unsung Hero. I mean, the accolades go on and on. Ms. Barnes, welcome to the spotlight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
First and foremost, for my listening audience, I'd like for you to give them an overview of who you are and what you represent.
Who am I? Okay, I am a longtime Tallahassee resident, one of a few that's still here. I think now we've sort of narrowed it down to we have about 22% native Tallahasseans. And I think that has really been an attribute, an asset. In keeping with what I do, as you stated, I did graduate from Florida A&M University, and of course my major is nowhere near what I am about now. I graduated in music. I was a piano major, voice, and then went on to guidance and counseling, worked with Department of Labor, and was a civil rights investigator for many years. And when I decided to retire from the Department of State, had already involved myself in some volunteer historic preservation initiatives, sort of brought into that by one of our renowned educators who passed away a few years ago, Miss Aquilina Howell. Mrs. Howell got me involved in the Greenwood Cemetery Restoration Project and membership on the Florida Heritage Board, and so following her around, I developed this love, this appreciation, more of an appreciation, I would say, for preserving history. And so that's what got me to where I am now, and it's been a very fruitful journey. It's been a very satisfying journey as far as being able to help both young people and adults.
When you look back at your extensive career and where you are now, from an inspirational, motivational standpoint, who stands out in your life, the person that pushed you, motivated you to succeed and to be ultimately successful?
You know, Vincent, I always have to go to my parents, because my parents, given the odds, accomplished way more than people now with a lot of education, a lot of money. My parents came from very humble beginnings. My father grew up on Wilani Plantation within a tenant farm family. And my mother was born and grew up on the McClay Plantation out Meridian Road. Now, my mother's parents were not sharecroppers or tenant farmers, but her father was the caregiver, the overseer, caretaker of the property. So my mother was a 10th grade graduate. There were 12 in her family. Her mom died when she was in her 40s. Being the oldest girl, my mother had to drop out of school to take care of the other children. My father completed third grade. But I would have to say that with that third grade education, My father knew way more than high school graduates, some college graduates, particularly when it comes to the math. Men during that time, and I say men because I'm speaking about my father right now, men back then, when they added numbers, they added the columns down with no pencil, no paper. My father could just look at the numbers three row columns down and just, I don't know what system he used.
Without pencil?
No pencil, paper, no calculator. No, and he would just add. And so I think about my parents coming from that background. Of course, there were like eight children and my father's siblings of my father. And I remember the many years of going back to the country, we called it, to Wilani Plantation, the Miccosukee Road area, going up Meridian to pass where Mom really was from, McClay and the Waverly Plantation, where they grew up, and visiting our ancestors. And looked like every time one of my great uncles or aunts would pass away, it left such a void with me. I was one of the children of the nine who, whenever my parents would go to visit their ancestors, I would always want to go with them for some reason or other. And usually I had to sit over by the fireplace or something because they didn't let young children into conversations.
Grown folk talk, right.
But for some reason, I just liked being around and seeing Aunt Vinya and Aunt Liddy and Uncle Lloyd and Uncle Mose. And they were just special people. And as I said, as they passed away, it looked like I would just long for. There was something that said, I really wish I knew more about them, or they could have been here longer with us.
From a historical preservation standpoint, were you able to capture any of that, or did anybody in the family capture any of those stories?
See, I think that might have been what kind of led me to where I am, because unfortunately, though we were around them, I was around them a lot, I did not get an opportunity to really write anything down. Well, first of all, we didn't have tape recorders like, they're just lucrative now.
Yeah, digital recordings.
Yeah, cameras. Right. We didn't have those kinds of things. So that might be a part of the reason why I'm so adamant about doing oral histories now and saving collections and what have you. But to go back to the inspiration part, though my parents came from meager educational backgrounds, all nine of us went to college and graduated. Now, if you take many families now with one or two, and they are struggling, but when the seventh one of us graduated from Florida A&M University, my parents received the President's Award from Dr. B.L. Perry for having graduated so many children from the university. And even since the nine of us graduated, we've had their grandchildren, now their great-grandchildren. The granddaughter's up there right now. We've just had this line of Pembertons and Porters going through that institution of higher learning. So to me, that's what history is all about. That's the value in teaching history and holding it up, especially before young people, to say, look, it does not matter where the beginning is. It's all, the potential is the beginning. The results is the ending point. And so when you look at people like my parents, then you look at Mr. Riley out of the Riley House, same thing, born into slavery. But he went on to accomplish so much. So it's just a lot of lessons in that for both young people and adults, really.
And when you look at that, and I can see how they inspired you all to move to another level when you looked at what they had, but what they instilled in you, what's wrong with, and I'm just going to say today's generation, whereas we have access to so much, but it doesn't appear as though we're accomplishing as much as when we didn't have as much, if that question makes sense.
It does, but and I think it might come out of something that you just said, we have so much. And sometimes I tend to think we might have too much, that we don't know how to appreciate, and we don't know how to take a little something and make something big of it. And that goes for not just people in the grassroots community. I'm talking about across the spectrum, including people in the academic world. You take Riley House. That house was almost lost in 1973. Mr. Riley, as I said, came out of slavery, but he went on to become an educator. He was a principal for 33 years. But in studying his history, he gave his children more, much more than what he had. So by 1973, though he amassed all of this property and money, everything was gone except the homestead. And the city bought that, and the plan was to demolish it and put an electric substation there. A group of citizens who knew Mr. Riley, and he had been the principal of some of them, decided that the house should not be demolished, so they raised $95,000 to buy it back from the city. And, of course, our Joanie, setting it up as a museum and a research center, was not an easy undertaking because a lot of people didn't understand what we were trying to do. Some that you would think would have had vision enough to see what could come out of this little one house on the corner of South Meridian and East Jefferson, they just couldn't fathom it.
And what did you see at that time from a personal perspective, a historical perspective? What was the importance of saving this house?
I saw an opportunity to fill a void, to fill in the gaps, to have the world know something about our ancestry that heretofore had not been put out there in the public domain. I, through my lifetime, had watched people excel, go on to make contributions beyond, and I'm not belittling Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, Carter G. Woodson, but ordinary people who were responsible for the underpinning, if you would, will, of today's black middle class. Teachers, educators, domestic workers, these same tenant farmers, sharecropper families, a lot of their children went on to do better because they laid the foundation. So I saw an opportunity to tell some of those stories and get that message out there. One of our early board members, Wanda Whitehead, gave us our first line of focus, and it said, "To forget the past is to deny future generations their heritage and a foundation for hope." So we pinned everything those first, I would say, 7 years. That was always it. Whenever we did a public showing, every opportunity we got, to forget the past is to deny future generations their heritage and a foundation for hope. And that's what it's all about, hope. We were talking about hope before President Obama.
True.
That was our marching piece when we started out in January of 1996, thanks to Wanda Whitehead.
Wow. So now, give my listening audience an overview of the Riley House Museum itself. What's going on there? I know you have a 501c3 foundation. What could they expect to see? Is there something on the website? I mean, are there tours? Give us a complete overview of this house.
Okay, the Riley House was constructed in 1890. It was only the second home in the state of Florida to be listed in the National Register of Historic Places, and that means that the place is very significant historically. The first house was that of Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune, founder of Bethune-Cookman. So that shows you what level we were able to document the history to place that house in the register. Of course, I said Mr. Riley was the owner, the only owner until we came to be. Mr. Riley lived to age 97. It's a two-story house, 2,400 square feet. We got it fully restored in 1981. Of course, the museum didn't get in there until 1996 because we needed that cadre of people who would devote free time, volunteer time, to making it happen. So for the first 3 years, everybody who did Riley was strictly volunteer. Then in about the fourth or fifth year, there was a small stipend put in of $1,000 a month for the director. And I want to say that because a lot of times when people look at where you've grown to, they think somebody's making a whole lot of money off of this. But when you take a house that's 119 years old, there we've had to maintain the property. We've had to put in programs. We have to have we have an internship program, and we try to give all of our graduate interns a stipend. So there's a lot of overhead. So had it not been for volunteers like myself, retired, Miss Gloria Steele, who stayed with us for about 9 years, Geraldine Johnson, retired. I mean, we carried it. And to the point that now we are like the leader. The Riley House is not only a local program. We have an archive at Tallahassee Community College where the students and the public use. We are also like a professional association for other African American museums across the state of Florida. We are also now on the national scene. In May, for instance, I was recruited, commissioned to come to a conference in Buffalo, New York, a national conservation conference. I went. It was like there were like 400 some people there at Buffalo College. Eight of us were African American. I was one of those eight. Only one African American presenter, and that I was it. I was in Washington in June, and when I say I want you to think in the context of Riley, not Altamise Barnes, but Riley.
Riley
was at the table in Washington to talk about our statewide network model that was set up out of the Riley House.
So the Riley House itself is connected to other historical preservation organizations throughout the state?
We set up a network of museums, and there was a reason for that. When Riley went to the state of Florida in the auditorium to pursue the first state grant, this auditorium seats about 250 people. It was half full. And I looked around, and Riley was the only one of color, African-American, in that room to seek some of these grant funds. And I said to myself, you know, I'm pretty sure there are other people across the state who are interested in the African-American piece of America's history. So did a survey, and all of these people started responding, yeah, we're interested. So we put a conference together. And in 1997, in Tallahassee, we brought almost 150, 175 people here to talk about how to get African-American history into the loop of the mainstream historic preservation initiative. And that was the beginning of this network. So we've provided professional training. We do technical assistance. We are now training them in how to catalog, digitize their collections. And this last part is just at the beginning points. It's like a, what do you call it, ground floor.
Ground, okay.
Growth, swell. But people on the national level, you hear me say, they are coming into this. When I came home, I was in Atlanta last week for my family reunion. When I came home, on my email was another invitation for the Riley to come to Riley House to be represented at this international conference in Salzburg, Austria. And they wanted to know if I would come. Again, connecting to collections. They're trying to make sure that these historical papers and documents and artifacts are not lost in time.
Wow.
So that's October 28th, so I've never been that far.
So you get it right.
But I told them that I would do that on behalf of the Riley House.
What type of holdings are at the Riley House?
Okay, at Riley House, we have, I'm going to divide, kind of do a two-prong thing. First of all, the property itself is historic. Okay, then next, we have conducted a lot of research, and we do publications, we package history. So, for instance, we have documented education in the state of Florida, African-American education, from segregation to desegregation. In that packet, you have a children's activity book. You have a full book of about 250-something pages that talks about the early schools when segregation was in place, the educators, what have you. Then we have four banner stands, and we have a documentary of oral histories. That's an exhibit. It opened at the Riley House, then it went to the airport, and now it's traveling to three of our network museums across the state of Florida. It's going to Clearwater, Punta Gorda, and Delray. Then we documented, for instance, we packaged the Civil Rights Movement in Florida, and we have those same pieces. That's a traveling exhibit. Okay, so that's another component, publications. Then a third piece that we have is our, as I said, the network, how we are connecting across the world, I say. And one thing that we have been able to do, I think, is bring to the table that link, and we just changed our mission, as a matter of fact, because at one time we were saying the mission was to preserve the Riley House and African-American history. Now we say the mission of the organization is to preserve the Riley House and illuminate, document and illuminate the blended interrelationship of African-American, Native American, and European history through education and outreach.
So when you talk about the organization, is the name of the organization separate from the Riley House itself, the nonprofit organization?
It's kind of all one and the same, but the mission is folding in.
Okay.
Because the mission is to preserve the Riley House, but it's to also preserve African-American history through, and the other related history through, education, outreach, and advocacy.
So when you look at, I mean, from the humble beginnings when you had a lot of volunteers and now things have grown, where do you receive most of your funding? Through grant writing, donations?
That's the big concern that's on the table right now. You heard me say I retired.
Yes, you're retired.
In 1995.
You've taken on another full-time, full-time position.
Yes, this is my 13th year, ending 13th year. We've had 26 interns. The unfortunate thing is that we trained the interns, but we have not been in a position to hire anyone. So on June 20th, we had our annual retreat. And we brought in a professional consultant, Dr. Deborah Mack. And we also went through a map review last year, museum assessment review, from the Association of Museums out of Washington also. And the primary thing that they stated was that the Riley now needs to be looking toward transitioning and sustainability. So we are now trying to position ourselves during the next 2 years to write grants or acquire some funding to bring in that next generation, if you will.
Sort of like, you know, establishing endowments and things of that nature.
So before I can no longer think and transmit what I have in my head and my vision, we need to put that into somebody else's, some young, professionally trained person's
kind of like
thing to do.
The whole oral history, passing things
down
to make sure they...
It exists in perpetuity.
That's it.
The Riley House should be there and its programs. Too much has happened to let it go away. So we do have a young man coming back, Dr. Anthony Dixon. He's going with me tomorrow to Jacksonville to pick up our guests from the Smithsonian. We have three guests coming in tomorrow. One of them is the son of John Hope Franklin. They're coming into Jacksonville, and then they're coming on to Tallahassee. We're bringing them here for 2 days, and then they'll go on to Miami. But Dr. Dixon is going with me, and on August 3rd, he's going to start with us part-time. And we're going to now, we've been writing grants, but we've been writing them to help other museums across the country. We've just been wanting to help everybody. We'll help everybody. So Dr. Mack said, it's now time for the organization to start looking inward to help itself to make sure that what you're doing will carry on. So you need to be looking for money for at least three positions. And she told the board, you've had one person doing the job of three people. So you need to write for three positions. One needs to be a resource development officer.
Wow.
And we are looking for someone to match. We do have a small endowment.
Okay.
And we are looking for a company, to a business or individual to match that endowment.
Wow. And right now, do you have a website available and any contact information while we're on this?
Yes, we have a website. It's www.rileymuseum.org. And we also have a website for our statewide network, which is FAAHPN, and that stands for Florida African American Heritage Preservation Network .com. So we are online. And we are linked into a lot of things, from the National Trust to IMLS to on and on.
When you look at the preservation of this history, let's talk about the preservation of individual or family history. How important is that? And I know you kind of talked about it from your life's experience, but, you know, we're in summertime now and the family reunions are going on and everybody goes to family reunion. You know, you show up and every now and then some people that were there last year are not there. And everybody's saying, wow, I wish I would have recorded this or would have gotten a little bit more information. What do you say? What's the importance of that?
It's very important to do that. And we have had more and more families getting into the genealogy side of it. I was on the phone just this week with a gentleman who was trying to get back to that fifth, sixth generation, and then he called me back 3 days later to say, oh, I'm just so excited. I found my great-great-grandmom and all of those other people. So we're finding more and more people are looking beyond just to get together and have the banquet and the picnic, and it's important that that happen because, see, I lost my mom January 2nd of last year. January 2nd of 2009, this year. And my mother provided a lot of the support and the information that I needed. I was fortunate to have all of the input. Not only did she help me with Riley, but my mother helped me when helped McClay, because they had these folders that were like 10 folders that only had colored workers on it and a lot of photographs. I took it to my mother, who was then like 96, and she was able to identify everybody in the folders.
Wow.
And then steer us to where we could go to get the oral history. So we did three volumes of books for McClay Garden, documenting the blacks who used to work and were the foundations, really, for the building of McClay. So to get to your question, it is very important before they people leave with the stories. And another thing that, and I probably shouldn't reveal this too much, but we have conducted over 250 oral history interviews. And a lot of the people, I would say 80% of those people are no longer living. And I want to couch that in a way so that I can bring people who would love to hear that last voice that Mr. such and so spoke.
Sound recordings, I mean, to actually hear the voice of your ancestor. It's just something that's powerful because there's nothing like the human voice.
Yes. Now, what I did, I have a nephew who worked for Fox for a while. He's with the power company now in Alabama. But I had him to put them on CD, DVD, convert from VHS to that, to at least get me to that spot. And at the reunion, I was talking with him. I said, now I'm ready to pull this off and do some kind of a publication. And then from there, I'm hoping that somebody will want to interview these people, because some of these people now would be 100, 105, 115. And they talk about life growing up in the South, growing up in Florida, growing up in Leon County.
And since you...
But we need funds. It takes resources.
It takes money. It takes money to do that. What was life like for you, Ms. Barnes, growing up?
Yes, there were six girls and four boys in my family, so I guess we could have easily gone astray thinking about the way things happen today. But I also say that we lived very sheltered lives. My mother was very protective of us. When people talk about the civil rights movement and the protests, for instance, we couldn't participate in civil rights movements. We were encouraged to watch what was happening on TV, to read about it. The only thing I remember is when Stokely Carmichael and those people would come to Tallahassee, we could go to the churches to hear them, but my father had to take us. My father brought us back home. I remember once a young lady was raped in Tallahassee by four white gentlemen, and my mother allowed us to catch the bus to go up and watch that trial every day. And I think that probably was her way of saying to us, you need to be careful. We could do those kinds of things. I say to people, I didn't go to a movie until I was out of the house. If we went to basketball games, my father had to take us or my older brother, and he would sit out there, and when the game was over, you had to make your way to the car and get back to the house. But they gave us opportunities. You heard me say I was a music major. Everybody in my family took piano lessons. My oldest brother, when he went to the military, he gave us two things in 1952, a television and a piano. And so my mother and father paid a man by the name of Willie Hall, was a musician in Tallahassee. They paid him 25 cents a week to come and give us all piano lessons.
25 cents a week?
Yes. And then we were all in the band. I played oboe in the concert band.
Wow.
And I played bass clarinet in the marching band. Another sister played French horn. Another one played, two of them played clarinet. So we had the social things in life. We had those things that helped to make children well-rounded. Now, I will also say that my father's job was at Lewis State Bank, which was the only bank in town. So we had access to that part of society, too, because we would go with him a lot of times for side jobs that he would have for some of the Lewis family people, and there were certain things that they would do to help my father, you know, make sure that we were cared for. So, in a way, I think we came up in a pretty good environment, and on our street, all of the other families, we probably had the first ones to go to college, but then the other families who had like eight children or whatever, it was almost like everybody followed suit and people were going to college. Though we weren't in an upscale neighborhood, we were in Springfield, in the hood.
In the hood, wow.
But a very strong religious background, because my pastor was Reverend Moses Gerald Miles, who was the dean at FAMU. And so
Gerald
Moses Miles. So he was with us, you know, all my life. And the Sunday school teachers were our school teachers. So we were in this rich environment.
There was this sense of community as well, and all this connectivity as well as interconnectivity.
Right.
When you look at today and based on your life's experiences, what would you say to a young lady now to help them be successful? If there were three things that you could share with a young lady listening right now, what would those three things be?
One of the things would be to get as much education as you can. Stay focused. Decide what your focus is going to be, and one of those should be education. In my household, if anybody talked about when I get married or would I move in my own house, right quick, my mom would say, that's when you finish your education. And we knew that meant when you finish college. There was no question about where your education ended. And so that's what young women should remember, young girls. Get a college education. The second thing is you don't have to be concerned about Mr. Right too early. That will come. And keep oneself in a way that Mr. Right will appreciate what he's getting when he does come along. And a third would just be to try to emulate the best quality that you can in womanhood, finer womanhood. It distresses me so much. Sometimes I'm walking in the mall and all of a sudden I hear all of this profanity and loud talking, and I look over and it's some of our young women, some young girls, hanging out loud. It's not about that.
How do we correct that? As a people,
I think a lot of it has to do, well, of course, you spend most of the time in the home, so you know, a lot of it comes out of the home. But now I'm gonna tell you, I go a lot to where we spend the most captive time in our lives. To me, next to the home is in the church. Mm-hmm. Some churches, I think we condone too much. We've gotten to be too mediocre. We accept, you know, that'll do. I'm always tempted when I hear young people, and I know we all make mistakes with our grammar from time to time, but I seen, and where you at? I know with my two granddaughters, the minute they say it, I said, what was that? And, oh, I'm sorry, Grandma, Miss so-and-so. We need to, churches, I mean, I think, churches as an institution, camps are okay, but what are you doing with the vacation Bible school camp? It's all right to study the Bible, but the Bible also talks about being the best that one can be, being good stewards of the resources on earth, and using talents wisely. But we have to make sure that our leaders, our pastors included, are speaking correctly when they are in front of the congregation. Watch what we infuse into the service as spiritual. Some things are spiritual and some are secular. I don't care what name you give it.
I understand exactly what you're saying. And it's like there's so much that has crept in, and I don't know. I mean, I was born in 65, so, you know, but I understand. And as I look over my history, there was a richness in the community as well as the church. And the church was almost another foundation for the home. And it helped to develop and to grow and to nurture people, not just from a spiritual standpoint, but holistically. And I believe what I'm hearing from you is that is lost today.
Mm-hmm. Yep. A simple thing, coming out of music again. Most of our choirs now, if you ask them to sight read one piece of music or follow the line in a hymn book, a lot of young people wouldn't even know what you're talking about. But there's a value in that. When you have, sometimes now I have people say, well, boy, you're doing three things. How do you concentrate on that? People who follow things like music, and some even say art, but I wasn't in art, you learn how to do different things because you've got to memorize your music, you've got to keep your keys moving the same.
The ability to multitask and to do different things.
That's important.
And one thing, what bothers me with regard to music and the way music is written today, and we're talking about in the church, it's just everything's three-part harmony. I'm like, where's fourth part? I mean, where's some bass or some, you know, baritone is just basically alto, soprano, and tenor. I'm like, where's the bottom? Mm-hmm. You know, because I was in music, and you always have to have a bottom, and that's what just bothers me. So right. I like some old time music where they have four-part harmony.
Right. And then they don't, everything is like call and response. I'm going to heaven. I'm going to heaven. I'm going to heaven. I'm going to heaven. We learned a lot as far as reading fluency by following those lines in the hymn book. And I have two little children who sit with me now at my husband's church every Sunday. And that's what we go through this thing. Okay, now look, what page is the next hymn? And they have this thing between the two of them, finding the next page. And then one little boy, no more about five, six years old, but he's there, and I see his finger going, and then he knows to come on down here, come down here, then go over here. You're teaching reading.
And what fluency. I'm hearing, and the thing is, what I see that is missing is this whole transfer of knowledge and bottom line teaching. It's just being lost, and a lot of our young people are being allowed to be raised on their own. And then we look and say, well, what's the matter?
Right.
Got to look at.
And then we as adults accept mediocrity in other adults. If someone makes a mention that, you know, that person really needs to go back and kind of take a 101 course, you know, so they know that A before whatever should be. Then they'll look at, well, what difference does it make? And these are, a lot of these people are academic people who will ask that question. And so it's sort of been like a dumbing down, if you will. Anything will do.
And if anything does do, where will you end up?
Yes.
I mean, looking back, it's kind of like if you don't preserve your history, looking back 5, 10, 15 years from now, what will be left? Where do you see... I mean, you've been with the organization, what, 13, 15?
13 years solid.
Years. Mm-hmm. Solid. How much longer?
As long as I'm able to give something to the organization, I plan to do that. I do feel strongly that it's time to transition to that next level because nothing lives forever. And I would like for the Riley and its programs to continue in perpetuity. So as a board member, as a connection for the younger person who's going to come along to help them make the right relationships or whatever, I will always be that philanthropic resource.
And for someone who's interested in coming by the Riley House, are there any fees? Do you give tours?
We give fees, and for a while we didn't charge an admission, but I did a fellowship at a museum down in West Palm Beach for 2 weeks, and the director told me that about 6 years ago. He said, you always charge something. First of all, you are a nonprofit. You have to keep the doors open and the lights on. And people appreciate more what they pay for.
Yes.
So we set a fee for $2 for adults. $2. That's the admission fee. We have a special exhibit there that's $5. But we tend to try not to turn anybody away. We do a riding tour also, Landmarks and Legacies. We'll do a step-on guide for $100. If a group has their own transportation, then we'll do a step-on guide and take them on a tour of the city. So between the tours, admission fees, the grant writing that we are able to do, and I do the grant writing, so we're trying to get a more experienced grant writer aboard. And then we have our gala event, which is a fundraiser. We have our rockathon, which is our holiday fundraiser. And we have a membership structure.
So talk a little bit about the membership, because my listening audience may want to join.
Well, with the membership, and it's on the web page, we have different categories, all the way from a student membership of $20 up to $2,500, and then we are now trying to push our planned giving program. We have what is a Riley Forever Circle, and people who want to make a substantial donation, like if they want to put a $2,000 CD over there, that will always stay there, and the organization can draw from it each year from the interest to support the organization. Then those are the Riley Forever Circle. group. When and you call, they can call 850-681-7881 and give us, you know, leave the information if we aren't there. And my the email address is staff@rileymuseum.org.
When you think about your legacy, when you finally step away from the Riley House and you pass the reins to someone else, what would you like to be have said about your tenure at the Riley House?
You know, it's interesting. I never really think about my legacy.
I mean, what would you want to be remembered for?
Well, maybe just remembered for inspiring people to be more cognizant of their history, their ancestry. It's a lot that comes out of that. Your health issues, why you have glaucoma, why you have diabetes. A lot of things come out of knowing where you came from. To me, to not know, if I had never known, and I hope I won't offend anybody, if I had never known my father or my mother, sometimes I just have to kind of imagine, you know, how difficult that would be, perplexing that would be. So to me, to not know where you came from, I just don't relate to that.
And here's a tough question, because we always say hindsight is 20/20. Looking at all of your accomplishments, everything that you've done, if there was one thing that you could have done a little differently, what would that have been?
I probably would have maybe waited a little longer before I married at a very young age, considering. And I think that's why earlier when I made that suggestion, I probably would have waited a little longer, though I had completed, but I married right after college. But I might have even gotten into what I'm doing now sooner, and might have even accomplished more by now in terms of helping others understand this whole historic preservation concept and what have you, had I not entered into that part of my life as early. Because then you have the family that you have to see after, and so that kind of took its, you know.
So any books for you?
Well, yeah, I've written two, and I mentioned those oral histories. I'm looking to do something with that, because I conducted all of those oral histories. So that would be my separate book. The first one that I did was mine, along with a classmate. And the second one was mine, along with a master student from Florida A&M. So this third one, I want to really put these oral histories together.
And thinking about those oral histories, is there one story that stands out that you could share from all the oral history, something that just stands out in your mind?
There's one that I've related to a lot of people, and it's of a lady who passed away about 7 years ago now, but she was 93 when I interviewed her. But she was obviously from a mixed relationship, race relation, white father, black mom. But she told this story of how that relationship came about. And, you know, sometimes we think of how we think in terms of when situations that like that happened, that maybe an owner took advantage of a slave mm-hmm. woman or something. But in this one, the way the story was related, it was obviously more than that. And in fact, when the mother took this lady away, because they soon left the plantation and moved up north to Lake Ammonia area, And the mother went back to get the daughter. The slave owner didn't want, the former slave owner didn't want her to go. And for several years, he would make trips to this new place looking for this lady who had had, you know, the children for him and this relationship. And at some point, she just assumed he passed away because they stopped hearing from him. But it's a kind of love story of sort with some bitter pieces, you know. So I like that story. And I've even said to Dr. Valencia Matthews at FAMU that one day I would like to see the Essential Theater do a play around that.
Wow. It has truly been a pleasure, Ms. Barnes, having you in the spotlight. And I'm going to give you the last few minutes here to just say whatever's on your heart and in your mind.
What is on my heart and mind as we enter into this two-year marketing plan, was really a five-year marketing transition sustainability plan, I would just like for our local government, our public institutions, the community, to explore, examine, come by and see what the Riley House has been about, how much it has expanded, how much it is touching the, not just the country, but the international piece, and to collaborate with us and find a way to help us make sure that the Riley House is around for another 119 years.
And with that, would you be so kind as to give the web address and contact information again?
The web address is www.rileymuseum.org. And the other address is www.faahpn.com. We are looking for someone to match an endowment, a $360,000 endowment. And we are looking for people to become members of the Riley Forever Circle.
Wow. Thank you so very much for a wonderful interview, and thank you for accepting my invitation to be a guest in Mr. Speaker's Spotlight. You've been listening to Mr. Speaker's Spotlight. This is the August 2009 edition, and my guest has been Ms. Altamise Barnes. This edition was brought to you by J-Centric, the key to your recording and entertainment needs. You can contact them at 850-385-6309. That's 850-385-6309. They're there for all of your recording needs, audio restoration, CD duplication, live recording, and studio recording. That's J-Centric, the key to your recording and entertainment needs. Like always, be good, be blessed, but most of all, be a blessing to someone.